This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. The show is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax, Virginia, but serving the entire Washington, D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about OF&P, visit us on the web at www.ofplaw.com. Also, I invite you to subscribe to my blog, blueprintforwealth.org, where we have topics on taxes, estate planning, and business planning in video form, audio form, including all of our old radio shows archived there, as well as articles that you might be interested in. And lastly, I invite you to read my monthly column in the Washington Business Journal entitled Blueprint for Wealth. Last month's column dealt with some very, very interesting topics on estate planning. Next month's column may do the same. So tune in to Blueprint for Wealth on the radio, in video, and in the Washington Business Journal. Today, we're going to be talking about when your kid is a reckless spender. What do you do about that? Well, I can't advise you on how to raise your children, but I can advise you on how you might want to structure your estate planning and your financial affairs to ensure that the child is not incentivized to continue the bad behavior or spending that is out of control. Wealthy families often breed reckless spenders. Many parents are left in a bind when they're devising their inheritance plans as a result of the spendthrift qualities of their kids. The parents need to develop a plan. The plan will monitor the sons and daughters who are spendthrift, meaning that they just like to spend money and don't know how to save a dime, while respecting the kids' independence and giving them some room to grow and room to mature. For sure, it's a delicate balance, but parents who employ innovative financial education and training and carefully choose their trustees and also use very cleverly and carefully written trust agreements can find hope that there is hope for their high rollers who are offspring. So here are some tips that you might want to consider if you're in that bind. And it's not just for the very, very wealthy. It's for people who have insurance policies or people who have equity in their homes. If they die, are they going to just leave the assets? Are you going to leave your assets outright to your spendthrift child? Well, one of the first steps you might want to consider is to make an honest assessment of your kid's financial knowledge. One way to do this is to set up a family investment company, either in a limited liability company or a limited partnership, that controls some of the money that you are going to set aside as part of their inheritance. So try that. I've done this before for a couple that had concerns about how their kids would handle an impending inheritance. The couple put their three kids on the board of the limited liability company. They had them interview investment advisors and hold quarterly strategy calls. The company also paid for financial education programs for the kids. Now you see where we're going with this. We're using this as a vehicle to try to educate the kids, but get them directly involved and have them make decisions. When the quarterly investment calls were held, the parents got to listen in, but we specifically instructed them not to talk on the calls and just listen on how the kids handled themselves. In one instance, the parents were surprised to discover that two of the three kids that they were worried about the most, one who was a teacher and one who was a social worker, asked great questions and excelled in the investment calls. But the kid that they had expected to be best equipped to handle an inheritance. Their son, who worked in the finance industry, showed he had real trouble handling his own money. He was literate, in the mechanics. He understood how things worked, but he didn't understand how to really own the wealth and to manage it for his own benefit. Having your investment company will help you spot these problems early. They may be able to help you use this as a trial run so that when the kids inherit a much larger sum after the parent's death, after your death, they can handle it. Not all families have to make such elaborate preparations. Not everyone needs an investment company. Simply including your kids in meetings with your financial advisors may go a long way. Now, I know some of you are reluctant to do that because you really don't know, want to know what your kids, you don't want your kids to know what you have. And so, therefore, you may not want to inform them about all of the goings on in your estate or in your retirement accounts or in your financial accounts. But if you're willing to open the book and educate the kids as you go along, it can be a very helpful tool. Parents also should help their kids deal with the psychological effects of inheriting great wealth. This may require the assistance of a therapist, believe it or not. For many people, there's a lot of guilt associated with receiving a large inheritance. Why? Because you didn't earn the money that you inherited. Your parents did. And perhaps they reminded you of that over and over and over again during their lives. So there may be a little bit of difficulty in handling it. And so you may want a little bit of help in talking out that issue so that you don't feel so bad about it and that you use the assets wisely as you go along in your life. Second big problem is not picking the right trustee. Or how do you pick the right trustee for a spendthrift child? Many spendthrifts could benefit from having two trustees manage their inheritance. Now, I know many of you out there say, well, you know, I really don't want to use a bank or a corporate trustee. But the use of a corporate trustee can help control the purse strings, and they can play the bad cop role with the spendthrift child when it's necessary, avoiding the need to put another family member in that position. Corporations that provide these services include Wilmington Trust Company, U.S. Trust, and BB&T, among many, many others. The second trustee can be a co-trustee with the corporate trustee. Now, again, corporate trustees can be expensive, so I'll give you an alternative to that in a second. But the second trustee will report to the corporate trustee on the beneficiary's progress in improving his or her financial acumen, his or her financial knowledge. This should be somebody who knows the kid well, but isn't too close to them. It might be a longtime family friend. It might even be the family's accountant or an attorney. And it doesn't always have to be a trusts and estate lawyer. Now, experts say not to assign this role to an immediate family member. And as I indicated, it's most of our clients' preference to do so because you trust the immediate family member. And the reason for that is that there may be potential friction with the immediate family member. Let me give you an example of a situation that I've seen happen before, and it's a change in facts to protect the innocent. Do you want somebody glaring down at you at the Thanksgiving table if you're the trustee because you didn't give them money? You may want to consider making the spendthrift child as a co-trustee as well. This role could serve as a kind of apprenticeship, and the head of the trust would be a corporate trustee, but the individual co-trustee might actually be the spendthrift child, him or herself, meaning that that child will not have the right to take a distribution from the trust without the consent of the other trustee. Now, you can also have, as I mentioned, an accountant or a lawyer serve alongside of that child. And they usually understand that the role of trustee is one of a fiduciary, one who is there to make sure that the trust assets are protected for the beneficiary for their lifetime or for however long the assets are going to be held in trust. If it's till they're age 30, 35, 50, or beyond, the trustee has that duty. If you put the kid in charge of the trust by himself or herself, then you don't have any protection against the spendthrift child pulling the asset out for himself or herself. But with a corporate trustee or an individual who is an accountant or an attorney, you do have that type of protection. Getting help from outside the family can be especially crucial for kids whose money woes may stem from substance abuse problems. Let me give you a case that I was going to describe for you a second ago. Let's say we've got a drug-addicted person who this individual just really cannot manage their affairs because they're so addicted to drugs. And let's say the person's in his mid-20s, in and out of work, can't keep a job, has no permanent address. I've seen the situation where this guy would stop by his mother's house periodically to pick up cash to get a distribution out of his trust. The mother, who may have been the trustee, knew that some of the money was going to buy drugs. It was really impacting the relationship between the mother and the son to have to be the money cop. In other words, having to protect the child from himself in addition to just trying to be a mother. So we've set up a system for other clients through which the spendthrift son might regularly stop by the mother's bank, who might be the co-trustee, to pick up a prepaid debit card. If there's a relapse in drug use, the mother and the bank or the other co-trustee would cut off the beneficiary from the use of the debit card. In other words, not replenish the balance so that they can't just go out and continue the abuse. The child might bristle at this. They might not like it. But I believe that this is one way of regulating the behavior and still not cutting them off completely from the assets that they may need for their support. Now, there are also trust rules that you can put in, and that is drafting the trust so that it's not so specific, but it gives the trustee guidance in how to interpret the language of the trust and take care of the beneficiary so the beneficiary is not hurting himself or herself. And that's where we come in. If you need help in drafting your trust to accomplish these objectives, give us a call at 703-218-2100. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in just a few moments.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
Depending on the nature of the business entity, a business may need several kinds of insurance to guarantee coverage. A business may need contents insurance to cover inventory and supplies. General liability insurance may be necessary to cover accidents that occur on a property. Business owners may also want to obtain coverage on motor vehicles used in the business. Besides insurance for the business, the owner may want to obtain insurance for the business's products and actions. If the business performs repairs or services, completed operations insurance may be necessary to cover occurrences when a customer claims injury or damages after using something that was fixed by the business. To cover claims arising from products, the owner will want product liability insurance, and for professional services, such as a law firm or medical practice group, professional liability insurance may be necessary to cover damages. If you want more information on the types of insurance coverage you need, contact one of the experienced business lawyers at Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Ruth Ann Clark. Welcome, Ruth Ann.
Good morning.
It's great to have you with us. Ruth Ann is a senior market director for Wells Fargo Bank in the commercial banking sector. And a little bit about her background, she's a graduate of William & Mary, concentrating in finance. I was there at the same time you were there, studying something different. But
I'm sure I was much younger.
Not that much. And then she graduated with an MBA from the University of Maryland, concentrating again in finance. What was your reason for being interested in finance? Why did you gravitate towards that?
Well, my father was in the Navy, and I was the oldest child, so I really knew nothing about working outside of the military, and I knew I didn't want to do that. So I knew I wanted to do business, and when I went in to the dean's office at William & Mary my sophomore year and said, I don't really know what I want to do, he said, you should do finance. It's sort of the jack of all trades. And I thought, okay, finance it is.
Huh. And so you're not from this area. Being in the military, your dad being in the military, did you live all over?
We lived in between Charleston, South Carolina, and Groton, Connecticut. So you can tell he was a submariner.
Submarines,
With a stint in Hawaii.
Oh,
and
that would be
then
fun.
Back to Connecticut. And then he moved when I was a senior in high school down to Norfolk, Virginia. So I moved with the family down there and was close to home at William & Mary.
So you went to William & Mary. What brought you up to Washington, D.C.?
Well, somehow along with the finance degree, I decided that I wanted to work for a bank in Baltimore as a senior. My father went to the Naval Academy. My grandparents were in Annapolis. And that was sort of the stable home because we moved all the time. So being close to Baltimore, I worked there for 3 years and then moved to Washington 3 years out of college and just loved it.
So Baltimore didn't offer you the excitement of a cosmopolitan city such as D.C.?
That's correct. It was a little more, when people ask you in Baltimore where you went to school, they don't mean college, they mean high school.
So how long have you been here in D.C., in the D.C. metro area?
I lived in D.C. from 1986 until 1993, and my husband and I had a six-month-old, and we were commuting, and I thought, how are we ever going to do this? And so we packed up and moved to Virginia Beach for 10 years, and I tried to come back after four, but it didn't work out. So after 10 years, we moved back from Virginia Beach to D.C., January 2nd, 2003, and have been here since.
You and I have a similar path. I was down there for a while, too. It's a great place to live, but it's a tough place to work. And D.C. offers so many more opportunities, and I'm sure you've seen that. What's the D.C. market looking like from a commercial banking perspective?
We're very fortunate in this market to be supported by both the government direct spending and government contracting, which keeps the sort of the income rate, the revenue level, relatively high compared to the rest of the country. So we have not suffered as much as some of the other areas of the country, although that may be changing a little bit with the budget stresses.
Do you really feel that that's a possibility that government contractors are going to be hit just as hard as everybody else has been hit in the economy with budget cutbacks?
I think there will be some, and I think it depends upon what sector of the government contracting community you support. I think if you're in large weapons programs and some of those areas are the war drawdown, that you may be impacted more. But clearly IT and some of the medical services, some of the other smaller companies that are more focused in specific sectors will probably not be impacted as much.
So you work very heavily with government contractors, don't you? You've been doing that for quite a while.
Well, at Wells Fargo, we have a large government contracting practice because that's a lot of what's here. But we also do the commercial, consumer and industrial other industries focusing across the board. And I'm more in the business development side. So the relationship managers that we support may have a little bit more specialization, but I try to know a little bit about a lot of things.
Now, in what you do at Wells Fargo, are there specific types of businesses that you're out trying to bring into the company as opposed to, you know, certain sizes of businesses? Obviously, government contractors are of particular interest, but industry sectors that you're focusing on as well?
It's more from a size perspective. So in the commercial bank, we cover generally businesses from $30 million in revenues on up to about $1 billion.
Okay.
Our corporate bank takes over from there. And then our business banking group covers anything from about $2 million up to the $30 million. And the smaller businesses would then be handled primarily by bankers in the banking centers.
I see. So there is some delineation in terms of size. And you're more involved with, I guess, what I would call small, medium-sized to large businesses.
Correct. And the differences in terms of how we segment the businesses, both the complexity of the financing needs, the ability to pay for things like, some more sophisticated treasury services, and then also account loads of the relationship managers.
So what do you see being you're already starting to describe some of the differences in terms of complexity. You know, a business that has $2 to $5 million in revenue, their typical lending needs would be what versus a business with $30 to $100 million in revenue?
A smaller business generally tends to need things for working capital. They tend maybe to buy their buildings. They'll need equipment financing, things like that. It's much more, their financing is much more closely associated generally with the owner, and it's intertwined with the owner's personal wealth in addition to the business. The owners also tend to be much more, I'll call it sort of doing in additioning to sort of more strategic planning. Once you get up into a $30 million business, the financing needs may include some acquisition financing, again, working capital, but the needs are a little bit different than the working capital needs of a smaller business. And you tend then to, at that point, to start getting more professional management. You may have a full-time accountant, controller, CFO type that will assist you from that perspective. The insurance needs get to be different. Your retirement plans you offer may be different. Your everything just gets a little bit more complex, and the owner will start to move away a little bit from the business in terms of his personal situation.
Can an owner that is, the typical entrepreneur that's running a business around $5 million, $6 million, it's starting to grow, can they use a commercial banker such as yourself to help them grow the business to the $30 or $50 million range? And what types of things can you do to help them get there?
They can absolutely, I think, rely on a commercial banker. And the relying on the experience of bankers with other companies and listening to the advice, best practices from other, other entrepreneurs. And a lot of times the bank will understand what the financial profile needs to look like in order to make life easy to get financing. And the business owner can decide whether they want to do a higher risk strategy or whether they want to sort of run up the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are real opportunities to have a constructive dialogue with a banker about what the strategic objectives are for the business and how you plan today for those objectives 2, 3, and 4 years out, including an exit strategy. And if you start with the exit strategy and back into what the company needs to look like today, that strategy may be 20 years away,
right.
But it'll help them in terms of likelihood of success or increasing the risk of execution, as we like to say.
So everything from using financing to acquire other businesses, acquisition financing. How does acquisition financing differ from just straight commercial lending that might be asset-based lending?
If you're financing working capital, then generally it's a fairly short-term need. There's a fairly good view to what revenue will look like and cash flow will look like over the next year, and it's relatively easy to secure it by accounts receivable and or inventory and some kind of a collateral.
Or equipment, maybe.
Correct. And when you're looking at acquisition financing, A, you're injecting a significant amount of risk into the business, even though it may be a really solid business that you understand well with a good management team.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you're going to take on something like that, you run the risk that you don't know everything you think you know, and you're taking your eye off the ball of something that you've highly focused on, and things could get a little off the tracks. Then you combine that with the fact that if the value of the business, you need to have some equity financing in there in addition to the debt financing.
Right.
And it just becomes much more uncertain in terms of the revenue projections. It's a longer term loan that takes more cash flow to pay back. There tends to be less collateral, and so the bank is less sure of a repayment if the cash flow doesn't support the business, all of which injects a different amount of risk.
Which means that the interest rates may go up.
Correct.
Or collateral requirements may increase.
Right. Or you can use other financing sources. You could get some equity from an outside investor. You could ask the seller to take back a note. You could do it in an installment sale type basis. There are a variety of ways that you can accomplish the acquisition financing that reduce the risk, at least from a financial perspective.
And you, as the commercial banker, can bring your expertise in handling other transactions that you've been working with other clients on to help the newbie structure the transaction the way it might be most appropriate, in addition to using the lawyers and the investment bankers and others that are involved.
Correct. I think building the team with the attorneys and the accountants and all of those that are going to give you the perspective who've been there, done that before. The commercial banker, I think, can also give a view toward debt capacity as you start even to think about acquisitions. Almost like it's not quite as simple as pre-qualifying for a mortgage. In a
mm-hmm.
mortgage situation, there's sort of some very clear ratios. 26% of your income can go to your mortgage payment, 36% or whatever the number is today, to your total debt payments. In a commercial situation, it's really not a whole lot different from a conceptual standpoint, but we can start to give companies an idea of how much they could borrow, how much we would feel comfortable lending. Mm-hmm. They can start thinking about how comfortable they are living under that debt load on a daily basis or a monthly basis, and then figuring out what size acquisition they can make, whether or not they're going to need equity. Is it, is that the right type of business? Is mm-hmm. the revenue model the same? All of those kind of things way in advance of actually identifying an acquisition target.
Do you still get involved in the evaluation of these loans, or now you're really more involved in bringing in the new business to turn over to the commercial lending officers?
In the position I have today, I'm much more on the front end, but understand a lot about the finance and can talk at a very high level sort of about debt capacity, but then would quickly bring in both a relationship manager and a credit person that would really delve into all of the financial metrics and help map out exactly what the numbers show can be supported, and then go to the credit team to see about, you know, what the structure would need to look like, whether or not we can get the loan approved.
What are you seeing today in today's market? I mean, interest rates have continuously dropped, or they're just bottoming out. The long-term applicable federal rate for IRS purposes dropped below 3% for the first time that I can recall. And, these rates are just so low. It sounds like such an ideal environment to borrow in, yet a lot of my clients, the stories that they're telling me is it's not so easy to go get the money from the banks these days. What's your take on that?
It's as it is with the personal situation. If somebody has sort of over-levered from a mortgage perspective and has a lot of credit card debt, the banks really are not going to be willing to lend additional money in order to try and borrow your way out of that situation. And I think with particularly some small businesses, because their businesses fell off so fast, mm-hmm. they found themselves over-levered with too much debt. And additional money in that case from a bank is not going to help solve the problem.
Right. And the asset values declined as well.
Correct.
Which was supporting the lending in the first place.
So I think for those who have a good view of what revenue will be and have a plan to get out to deal with the revenue and demonstrate an ability to repay, the money is available. It's important, having come through the situation that we did, to have demonstrated the willingness to make the tough decisions, to cut back on the costs, and to leave money in the company, to reduce the level of risk and not employ significant expansion plans when it's a very risky situation to do that.
Is the government, with about a minute and a half left, is the government cutback in funding affecting the bank's mentality regarding future loans and lending policy?
No, not on that aspect. I think the issues that we as individuals face are the same as businesses face, and that is from the regulatory perspective and what is going to be the cost of doing business, when are rates going to start to rise, and when is the economy going to come out of the situation it's in today. Once those things start to improve, I think businesses will start to borrow again, and businesses and the banks will definitely be willing to lend.
We're talking to Ruth Ann Clark, who is Senior Market Director at Wells Fargo Bank. Ruth Ann, if people want to get in touch with you to find out more about the lending services and opportunities at Wells Fargo, how do they do that?
You can either contact me through my LinkedIn page. It's Ruth Ann Clark. I'm at Wells Fargo Bank. Or you can send me an email at ruthann.f@wellsfargo.com.
Outstanding. It's been great having you as a guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. And listeners, if you want to get in touch with Ruth Ann, check out her LinkedIn page. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth. Join me next week for another special topic and special guest. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 with your Blueprint for Wealth, right here on 1500 AM Federal News Radio.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated.